The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
If you're one of those people who devour all manner of self-help book, or if you're one of those people like to decode other people, or you work to achieve peak performance through goal setting and increasing your personal motivation, or maybe you engage in a lot of positive self-talk to try to reprogram yourself in a way that optimizes yourself as a human being. Well, and if any of those are the case, kudos to you. And I think you're going to find this program, this impending discussion, of value. As usual, this is Mike Consul, your host, and I'm joined on this episode by Michael Liersch. And you don't want me to read too deeply into his bio because he's one of those kind of guys who makes the rest of us feel as though we haven't really done very much with our lives. But you do need to know that he is the head of advice and planning and wealth and investment management at Wells Fargo & Company, where he is responsible for, and this is what our conversation will revolve around, developing and propagating research-based methods to help advisors and clients collaborate in the most productive ways possible around money decisions. Huge, right? Our lives kind of rise and fall on our resources in large part. So we're talking about human behavior, the psychology of money, and Michael Liersch getting deep into the gray matter of the people's heads that he works with and the clients, his research. And he's going to have a lot to tell us. So without any further ado, Michael Liersch, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me in the program, Mike. You've really set me up here to really make your audience be disappointed based on that intro. I appreciate it, though.
You're expecting nothing less than Nostradamus, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's start. I promised I wouldn't go very deep into your bio, and I won't, but I am going to include some of this first question, because in addition to earning your bachelor's degree in economics from Harvard, you got a doctorate in cognitive psychology from the University of California at San Diego. So I wanted, of course, to make mention of this, that part of your background, because you're quite involved in that now. I want to start off by just asking you, who is your favorite psychologist in the decorated history of the study of the human mind? Is it Freud or Maslow or R.D. Lang? Is there somebody who was really the person who really lit your fire the most, or who you read the most about?
Oh, wow. I wasn't expecting that question, Mike. That was a bit of a
surprise
for me.
I'm not a surprise. I want to see your dexterity here. Let's see how you handle a curveball.
So I do have a favorite. I don't always like calling out my favorites, Mike, but I will in this case. So I don't know if you've heard of a Nobel Prize winner named Richard Thaler. He goes by Dick Thaler.
Yes.
He is one of my top favorite researchers of all time. And here's why. He really highlighted the power of behavioral finance to the economic community in a fundamentally transformative way, where economic theory commonly looks at human behavior as something you can assume away. Dick said, actually, that's not true. Human behavior needs to be integrated into theory, economic, financial theory, and also be tested in practice. And I think that's what really is brilliant about what Dick did. And I really look at him as not just a thought leader, but someone who's influenced my life, frankly, Mike. So that's what I would say.
Good choice. Now, isn't there somebody who kind of followed in his footsteps now? He's the guy, I'm trying to remember his name. He's written best-selling books. I think he won a Nobel Prize. He's a sociologist, I believe, and an economist. His name escapes me right now. It'll come back to me. I'll look it up well as our discussion goes on. But I would think it sounds very much like you would like him as well a lot. But okay, Richard Thaler it is. In fact, we had a column written in the magazine, in Real Assets Advisor magazine, one of our seven titles, written by Greg Fisher of Gerstein Fisher. And it was an ode to Richard Thaler. So obviously, people with big brains like Richard Thaler. So there you have it, listeners. So explain to our listeners exactly what you do for the company. I mean, I've said a little bit about it, but what's the nature of the research you do? How would you characterize it, Michael?
So when you think about the research, especially as it applies to behavioral finance and behavioral science in general, Mike, that I do at Wells Fargo, it's really around human behavior with respect to how people make, and you put it earlier, money and financial decisions. But when you think about that research, I think a lot of people think that it's just about dollars and cents, Mike, but it really is about the translation of the meaning of money to human beings. And what people forget a lot is that a dollar is not a dollar is not a dollar, Mike. That the meaning of the money, where it was earned, how it was given, the source of that money, and also how it's intended to be used, actually gives that money a completely different value to the human that, again, has either stored it, received it, you know, has it, holds it, or is about to use it. And that's really the focus of our research, is how does that meaning influence the decisions we make for the better and for the worse? And how do we really dig into that, especially with clients and with advisors, so that they can collaborate on how to get human beings to where they want to go with their money? Does that help, Mike?
It does. So, you know, it leads to another question, which is, since you, I'm sure you've discovered a whole lot of things, but what's a piece or two of the most surprising things that your research has discovered?
So I don't know if I'd call it surprising, but can I give you one of my favorite findings over
Sure.
time? So one of my favorite findings over time is really around gender research. And this is something you mentioned, University of California, San Diego, where I got my PhD, which I just loved that experience, Mike. It was such a wonderful place to be. A lot of great researchers challenging each other, their thinking. And one of the things that comes up and came up there is this idea that men and women think differently about money. And whether that was true, whether that was not true, and if it was true, in what ways, if it was not true, why? And so what I've researched over time at the different organizations I've been at and now at Wells Fargo is that when you look at maybe some different aspect of that question, which is the types of things that men and women want to talk about, Mike, when it comes to money. What's fascinating is a lot of people have an intuition or a hypothesis that men and women will want to talk about different things when it comes to money. But when we actually ask men and women in very structured research questions what they want to talk about, the data comes out, it's actually very identical, meaning they value talking about very similar things, meaning not just about money, but about their work lives, about their families, about the social impact they want to have with their money. It's very similar, if not nearly identical, in terms of things they want to talk about. And then when we ask them, well, what do you talk about actually when it comes to money with your advisors? What's fascinating about both genders is that they don't tend to talk about those items outside of the financial domain as much as they want to. And so then the question is more interesting. It becomes less about gender and it becomes, why do human beings not address what matters most when it comes to their money in terms of those identity factors, in terms of that meaning? And that makes the research question more interesting. It becomes more human rather than specific about, you know, people's experiences, their age, their gender. It becomes more about the human condition and why we find it so uncomfortable to talk about money, Mike.
Yeah, people do find it, many people find it uncomfortable to talk about money. Now, you talk about men and women talk about the same things, but I would guess the approach is different. I mean, let me put it this way, true or false, women are more risk averse than men.
So there is a lot of evidence that there's a truth to that when it comes to actual investing and trading behaviors, Mike. But what you have to do is you have to ask yourself, is that really about men and women's brains? Or is that about some type of environmental context? So one great example of that is women tend to live longer than men, as I'm sure you know, Mike. And that's just a statistical fact, in particular in the United States of America. And when you think about those kind of risk decisions, that is what actually tends to be the factor that's driving that risk behavior, not the fact that you are a man or a woman. So if you know you're going to live longer, taking greater risk becomes more concerning, which leads you to a more conservative approach with your money because you want it to last longer. And you might debate whether that's the right decision to make or not, but that tends to be the outcome.
Well, I'll tell you what, here's an interesting one that doesn't exactly shed a very positive light on men, but the micro loan program, and it might be the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation or some other foundation, or maybe several of them do the same thing. In Africa, when they give money, it's only to the woman, not to the man. Because what they've discovered is the woman will use it to educate their children, to build a home, to build a security for the future. The men will go out and drink and do drugs and have fun with their friends. Now, that's not true of all men, obviously, but it's sobering to think that women think in terms of family and building a future, and men do tend to think in terms of let's go whoop it up.
But you want to, when you think about these, let's call it experiences that humans have, whether it's gender, again, age, whatever it may be, what's important to come back to, Mike, is what is causing those dynamics? And there's something called, I don't know if you've heard of it, and so I'm going to get a little dorky on you. Is that okay, Mike?
That's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, please.
So there's something called the fundamental attribution error. And I don't mean to flip this around on you because you are the boss of your podcast, but I'd love to test you. Is that okay?
Challenge me. Yo, no, challenge me the whole way.
Okay, great. So what I love about the fundamental attribution error, and it's a very famous psychological concept, is this idea that people tend to attribute behaviors to certain dynamics, and two in particular. One is to the human themselves, like intrinsically. So you might think a man or a woman does something, or you can attribute it to the context, to the environment, to the organizational structure. And so think of that as a system. So it can be the system or it can be the person, the human. And I want to ask you two questions. What drives behavior, or what drives more aspects of human behavior? Is it the systems that they're in, or is it the human themselves, their personality?
Well, if I was given a multiple choice, I'd say the systems. Although I would, if you left it open ended, I would have said fear.
Aha! I gotcha. So the system is what tends to drive more human behavior than the actual humans themselves. So organizations, systems, governance, rules, those are all extraordinarily powerful, the environment. But what's called the fundamental attribution error is that human beings tend to attribute it to the person, the human, you know, the aspects of that person. And so what's fascinating about that, Mike, is I think that's empowering, not disempowering. What it means is, and this is actually what Richard actually focused on, is the design of systems and how they affect and impact human behavior. When we think about it that way, the kinds of things that we're alluding to in terms of gender differences and other differences between human beings, we have to ask ourselves, is that the primary factor that's driving what people are doing with money, or is it the systems that are surrounding them? And when you think about it, if it's the system, what's great about that is if me, Michael Liersch, wants to change something about what I'm doing with money, I should probably look at the things that are surrounding me, the system I'm in, and how I can change that, rather than being so focused on having to change things about myself. And you mentioned self-help in the beginning. So really the self-help is actually to change my environment, not necessarily try to transform who I am on the inside. I hope that makes sense, Mike.
Yes, yes. And yeah, I went pretty far afield to Africa in the battle of the sexes. So I'm gonna ground this a little bit more, get back to the financial services aspect of this by asking you, you know, how do you really go about researching advisors and clients? What are some of the methods that you use?
So when we research advisors and clients, the key is really to think about the most important questions that are on people's minds, human beings' minds, and just talk about them first. So that's always the origination of the research. So one of my favorite questions that helps generate research, Mike, is what's the number one job you want to accomplish with your money? What is that? And so that actually can generate a lot of, let's call it follow-on statements and questions. So people might say, well, what do you mean by the number one job? What do you mean by what I want to do with my money? You know, are you talking about needs versus wants? So then people start trying to unpack the question. And so that's where we always start our research, is in important questions that human beings presumably should know the answer to, but don't. And then what it helps us do is say, well, how do we structure other questions or other research that helps people then get to those answers? And that's usually how we start all our research programs. So just to put a fine point on that, that number one job people want their money to do for them, most people say they've never been asked nor have answered that question out loud before ever in their lives. And so it allows us to say, well, why is that? And really what it comes down to, and you mentioned this idea of fear, Mike, it's fear of having that conversation. It's fear of the taboos around it. It's the fear of even articulating it, because once you say it, Mike, you start into this idea of commitment. I've said out loud what I want to accomplish, and now I need to do something about it. I need to understand whether I have enough, not enough, just enough, more than enough. I need to understand who should be involved. I need to start taking action. And so it allows us to really dig into that process and help advisors and clients collaborate around those concerns, those fears, those needs, so that we can actually help people structure a plan to get to where they want to go.
So what does human behavior tell us about investor / clients and the mistakes that they make when working with advisors? So there's your advisors, there's their clients. What about human behavior? Because clients make mistakes with advisors. I mean, you must arm your advisors with information that says, listen, there's going to be situations like this. If you were to counsel the clients, what would you tell them they need to do to maximize their interactions with their advisors and get the best outcomes?
So this is a really tough question, Mike, and I'm not going to claim to know all the answers, but I'm going to give you two factors that I think clients should consider when working with their advisors. Is that fair? Is that okay to do it that way?
Yeah, sure. Whatever you're armed with, whatever's going to, I'm not asking you to go beyond the bounds of your research. It's your show.
So the first thing, Mike, I would say is that I think a key mistake a lot of clients make, and this is just a general human error, is that we should divorce our money decisions from emotion. And there is that narrative out there that we should de-emphasize emotion, or we should try to eliminate emotion from all money decision-making. And frankly, I don't know if you've felt this, Mike, a little bit, but that's somehow irrational. Like we're somehow worse human beings by including our emotion in decision-making. And frankly, nothing could be further from the truth. There's a lot of research-based evidence that actually emotion is an extremely valuable tool to help us make much better decisions.
Unless the stock market is going down, then everybody freaks out. Doesn't the research say that most people lose money in a bull market because they don't, every time there's a little valley, they jump and they wait till the stock market's sky high in price and say, oh, wow, the stock market's doing so good. Let's buy stocks at 10 times the price I should have bought them at. I mean, the whole thing, the emotional investing sounds dangerous to me. I mean, disabuse me of that if I've got bad research on that.
So Mike, what I would do is to help us not confound things a bit. What you're talking about is emotion in the moment of a particular market event based on what I've invested in, and then the subsequent actions I would take. And so that's one type of emotion, Mike. What I'm referring to is when I'm making the decisions in the first place to make that investment, to expose myself to that risk. And what you want to do is be extraordinarily honest with yourself and your advisor about what you just said, how I would actually feel in that moment, given that market event. And by the way, it's not just, you know, the capitulation, but it's if the markets are rising, what am I going to do next? Am I going to want to throw more money at that particular investment that's been rising, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 1,000%, which creates another different set of risks, Mike. So what I'm saying is we should always be acknowledging and introducing our emotions, our feelings, our thoughts, our experiences into that decision-making process, because it's going to give us a lot of information, a lot of anticipatory perspectives on how we'll feel in that moment and allow us in collaboration with others. So in this case, an advisor or a spouse or a partner or our family members to really create, think of it as pre-set decision rules or ways in which we can design our environment again that will help us actually make better decisions when we get to the moments you're describing, because we've already recognized that we're going to feel a certain way, we'll be able to acknowledge it, and then look to our goals, what we're trying to accomplish, why we expose ourselves to that risk in the first place as the guide, rather than, to your point, those reactive, let's call it information vehicles via our emotions, as the guide in that moment out of context. Does that put a bit more context?
Yeah, so you're saying it's a short-term reaction, it's an immediate reaction to something that's going on. And obviously, advisors need to be prepared for that. It happens. And I know lots of advisors prepare their clients that, look, it goes up, it goes down, but draw a line across the peaks and look at how it's performed over time. But people tend to lose their faculties a little bit in the heat of the moment, like, on just a bad day. So let's talk about advisors. What characteristics? Your research tells you that there's certain characteristics that are possessed by the most successful financial advisors. What are those characteristics? And I would assume Wells Fargo goes out looking for this when they're recruiting investors or looking to sign somebody on. So what are those characteristics that really make for a great financial advisor?
So the greatest financial advisors, Mike, and this is research-based, really are able to articulate why they're in the business, why they're in the business of financial advice. And that goes beyond things like money or interest in money or interest in helping clients to make money or whatever that might be. The why is about something personal, something about why they got in the business, a moment. And those advisors who are able to articulate that, hone in on that motivation and communicate it to clients effectively, they tend to be the most successful advisors. So I'm going to give you a tangible example. So for example, me, Michael Hirsch, why I'm in the business is I love helping human beings make better money decisions. The reason why, Mike, and I'm going to tell you something personal, is that I came from a home where my mother wasn't given the ability or the opportunity to get great financial advice from, for example, a financial advisor. And so really, decisions were made that were not in her best interest because she just didn't know the information to make those decisions. And so mistakes were made and we ended up being extremely, extremely financially strapped, Mike. And in fact, you could say in poverty when I was younger. And so my motivation is to really never, never give someone that lack of advice. I always want advice for human beings. Make it more relevant to more people so they're never in that position my mother was in or I was in as a child. And so people can be empowered to make the best decisions. So I tell clients that story and I connect with them on that level. And it really drives me and it helps me problem solve for my clients each and every day. And so that why is core and critical. The two other ones I would highlight is you have to translate that why into what you do, what it is that you do to actually get clients to where they need to go. And that can be a variety of different things. And then ultimately how you do it, Mike. So do you do that through portfolio management? Do you do it through goal setting? You know, what are the connective tissues that get people to where they want to go in that codified way where you go from discussion to implementation to revisiting it on an ongoing basis? So I hope that helps describe.
Yeah, it does. It does. Now, can those characteristics be learned? Because once you've come to this conclusion, the research has led you there, you still have a battery of advisors who were hired before you had the screen to run them through. So can those characteristics be learned, or is success in the business largely just kind of hardwired into the personality?
So this gets back to into our systems versus people, and it can absolutely be learned, Mike. We can all be, let's call it, coached, trained. We can all transform ourselves into helping ourselves understand our why, tap into our motivations, what experiences drove us to do what we're doing and be passionate about it. That what and that how, that's really just about being really crisp and clear about your process, how you get clients to where they need to go. And then ultimately coming up with some really tangible examples, Mike, with clients that you work with, how you worked through certain problem statements with them, jobs they wanted to do with their money, and whether that was successful or unsuccessful and what you learned from it. So it can be definitely learned, Mike. Absolutely, 100%.
So what do clients need to know? And I think this is a little bit of a repeat of an earlier question, but I want to ask a little bit more directly. What do clients need to know about working with their financial advisor that would help them get the most out of those engagements?
So what clients need to know is they need to be vulnerable. And what I mean by that is, a lot of times human beings, and this gets back to your fear comment, they are, let's call it, guarded about the taboos around money. They're guarded about what they don't know and don't know about money. A lot of times there's a lot of intimidation. And so really being vulnerable about what you know and what you don't know, what you're confident in and what you're not, what you need help with and what you really don't need help with, and how you like to interact with an advisor or with another human being, frankly, in general, Mike, in terms of the levels of control you're willing to relinquish to that person or things you want to hold close to you. It's just so critical to really think about as a client when trying to find the right advisor for you. And I think a lot of times, especially that dynamic of control, who wants to be in more control, and also confidence, what I know and what I don't know, being vulnerable there is something that I would really encourage all clients to think about, and not just think about on their own, but with a spouse, a partner, a collaborator, maybe test that out with them so that they can be really honest and authentic about it, so they can find that right relationship for them when collaborating around money decisions. Does that answer the question more directly, Mike?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that's clear to me is that one of the biggest frustrations that advisors face, and I alluded to this earlier, I think there's two things I want to bring up here. One is that clients panic during down markets, and then they deviate from the program. And again, you were explaining that's kind of a reaction. It's a reactionary sort of thing. But then they're also quite fearful or reticent to get involved in non-liquid investments. And those aren't for everybody. If you're a person of very average means, you probably don't want any of your money to be illiquid. But there's a lot of people who have considerable resources, and it would make a lot of sense for them to have a diversified portfolio that includes illiquid assets that perform over the longer term, but it requires you tying your money up for 3 years or 5 years, let's say. So there needs to be, each of the advisors who are out there in the world need to obviously apply some of their own psychology here. What advice would you give to advisors who are working with clients who are dealing with either a down market or trying to get them past that, the reticence about getting into some illiquid investments, particularly if it's like, hey, look, you've got plenty of money. You've got, and you're not going to need access to all of it right away. And it makes a lot of sense. Stocks and bonds aren't going to keep performing like they have forever. In fact, they're supposed to stop performing over the next 10, 20 years in the way they have in the past. So long-winded question, Michael, but I'm bringing this one in for a landing now. what do you tell an advisor to do in terms of really trying to persuade their clients, effectively persuade them on some of these issues?
So I wouldn't even put it into the category of persuasion, Mike. what I hear you saying is, what's factually the way in which a client could invest to really help them achieve their investment objectives, or you could translate it, that into, let's say, their overarching goals or the jobs they want to get done with their money. So let's move it to that place instead of any sort of persuasion. Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, what you want to do is show the client what would actually get them to that fact-based place, you know, what's truly aligned, and then say, but do we need to make any tweaks based on your preferences, which is what you're ultimately alluding to. So what I would say is that taking a bucketing approach here, Mike, and we'll go back to behavioral science, behavioral finance, bucketing is extraordinarily powerful. I'm going to give you four quick buckets, and I want you to react to them. The first one is a cash bucket, which I think a lot of people forget about, Mike, which is, what is going to give me the psychological safety to stay the course with the rest of my financial strategy? And that's not an emergency fund, Mike, right? That's not the 3 to 6 months of, you know, money that I put into a bank account. I mean real psychological safety that will get me to stay the course with my again, broader financial strategy. The second bucket is really around lifestyle. So what do I need in terms of regular money to support my lifestyle? And so if I'm, let's say, no longer working, that might be a different view than if I'm working. And then the third bucket is really around, think of it as preservation. What money do I want to have regardless? So you can think of that, the dollar amount that a lot of people want to be worth. You know, what is that? And I don't want to go below it. And then the last bucket is this idea of a growth bucket, which is, I think, what you're really focused on here in this question, which is, what is going to get me to the growth goals that I have with my money? And so when you lay out those buckets and you really set up that foundation, Mike, what happens is then those illiquid investments you're referring to, they automatically or more naturally go into the growth and or the preservation bucket. The first two buckets, the cash and the lifestyle bucket, that's where people want to feel comfortable. They can access cash when they need it. They can access liquidity when they need it. And so giving them the confidence that that's going to be okay and making it factually true based on the client's cash flow needs and their lifestyle needs, that's what's going to get the client to where they want to go should an illiquid investment like you're talking about make sense for them. And I want to check in with you. Do you have any questions there? Does that resonate with you? Do you want to challenge me? What are your thoughts?
No, it makes a lot of sense. And actually, it spurs another question kind of around that. You know, there's people who are happy spenders. They like to, if they feel good when they spend money, then there's the people I would call fear-minded who they feel good when they got a lot of money in the bank and they keep socking money away for that catastrophe that they are just sure is around the corner. Or then there's the people who
That's me, Mike.
Is that right? Because I was going to ask you about your portfolio. I'll ask you about that in a minute. Then there's the commitment people. I tend to think of people who they look, I want to accumulate these resources, but I want to use them to support education or to support research or the arts, or I have extended family members who I want to leave this money to. They want to do good with their money. What about, what I'm asking you is, you know, number one, where do you fall into those three? Or maybe you'd create a fourth or fifth category. And is that, do you see a breakdown along those lines, or have I oversimplified it, or would you add, again, some additional categories?
I mean, I'm not going to disagree with anything that you've said, Mike. I mean, there's a reality to the three categories you've laid out. And there's also many more personas of human beings, Mike, in terms of their money behaviors. It's highly complex. I would say I was kind of joking around, but the idea of, you know, socking away money, not enjoying spending, all that kind of stuff. And remember, I shared with you my experiences as a young person. That's what drives my feelings there, frankly. And so there's a lot of research on that. Our past experiences, they really do drive a lot of our behaviors. And that's why those systems become so important to institutionalize, so that we can actually maybe put in place environments that actually help us to a better place if those experiences aren't serving us. And I will tell you, in many cases, you know, that desire for me to sock away money and hold on to it, that doesn't necessarily serve me in my financial life. And so I have those systems in place. And so, by the way, with behavioral science, Mike, They call it me-search, not research, just FYI. so that you know. But you know, yes, of course, there are many clients and human beings who love to spend money. And so I would say my wife, for example, is much more comfortable spending money than I am. But it's a great match, right? It's perfect because we can debate it, talk about it. And you talk about these accumulators who are accumulating in the way you put it is very purpose-driven, maybe even social impact-oriented, you know, perspectives. You know, they want to do something with their money in a very intentional way. So these things are true, but I would caution us to really stereotype people, Mike. There are different contexts. There are different ways in which we all exhibit these types of behaviors. It's really about the idea of being, again, vulnerable about it, talking about it. That's what I mean by bringing the emotion into it. Let's get clear on why we feel these ways, in what context, and with the people that are really collaborating with us about those money decisions. We need to be clear on whether we feel like those behaviors serve us, Mike, or not, and whether they're aligned with financial success or not. And that's when we get to put the systems in place that help us make decisions, to your point, in those tumultuous markets, or help us exhibit better cash flow behaviors, spend behaviors, save behaviors, whatever they may be, so we can live our best life. So that's how I'd answer your question. None of your personas are necessarily wrong, but they're not necessarily right either. They just are what they are, and there are many more of them. And so we should all just acknowledge, be honest with each other about them and talk about them and have fun doing it so that we can get to a better place as humans.
So if I was to look at your portfolio, I would see a risk-averse portfolio. True or false?
I would say that I wouldn't characterize it that way. I would say my portfolios are all very goal-oriented, Mike. And so what I would say is, All my strategies have a dollar amount, a future dollar amount that I'm targeting. And so that could be, you know, on an annual basis, whether, you know, I'd want a reliable cash flow or a certain dollar amount in the future, you know, to pay for something like education for my daughter, my 11-year-old daughter. So very goal-oriented. So dollar amount, a time horizon oriented with it. When do I need that money? And when does that need stop? So when does it begin? When does it end? And what are all those time periods in between? And then how important it is to me. So the priority level around it. And frankly, Mike, that's the governance, the systems I put in place that drive all my allocation decisions. So I would say I can't categorize it in the way you just did. It would vary actually based on those parameters. That's what I use as my guiding principle. And that's what I coach advisors and clients to really consider and think about in terms of driving theirs.
Okay, I hope your listeners are hearing what I'm hearing. I think Michael's trying to hypnotize me because he keeps saying Mike, and he emphasizes, he puts italics on that. It's a hypnotic technique, is it not, Michael? Are you trying to hypnotize me, or is that when you use my name repeatedly, is that just a way of connecting with me?
Names matter. Names matter. And we all like to hear our names. There's something called the cocktail party effect, Mike, where we can be in a
cocktail. So you just did it. You just tried to hypnotize me.
I did. where you can be in a cocktail party and it can be loud and all that kind of stuff. You've probably been in this situation. Someone says your name and suddenly all the noise fades away. And you can hear exactly what that person's saying, the sentence, the words.
Precisely. Precisely, yeah.
Names are powerful. So for all those advisors and clients listening, all those humans listening, getting names right. And you asked me how to pronounce my last name, Mike, earlier on. And
yes.
Names are so critical and important. Language is so critical and important. And you're right, Mike. I'm very deliberate with a lot of the things that I do. I'm very introverted by nature. So a lot of the things I didn't speak until I was nearly 4 years old. And there are certain periods in life where I found it hard to interact and speak with humans. You know, a lot of this is me studying and me practicing and really studying the power of language. A lot of that is in behavioral science. So yes, it's intentional. I'm not trying to hypnotize you, but I'm trying to recognize that you're an important human being and that I need to respect your questions and check in with you and see whether the things I'm saying make sense or not so that I can adjust, adapt, and make sure I reflect your goals, your values in this podcast, Mike.
Now, you know, early on, I mentioned self-talk. During the introduction, I mentioned self-talk, and I read a book years ago by a psychiatrist whose name is not going to be immediately available to me. But the name of the book is what's important. It's called What to Say When You Talk to Yourself. And I was told about this book by a woman who said she had been suicidal until she heard about this book. And if you had met this woman, I met her at a cocktail party. And I got to tell you, she was the farthest thing in the world from somebody you'd ever consider suicidal. And of course, she wasn't anymore. But to even think that she was ever suicidal was would seem like folly. And it dates even farther back than that, though. I was had a person who was a freelance writer for a newspaper. I was in my 20s at the time. And she told me that she would, when she went to a job interview, she would get there early, go to a cafe across the street, sit and have a cup of coffee and tell her all these wonderful things about herself in the privacy of her own head, just that kind of self-talk. And she'd go into the interview feeling mightily confident. I've used that technique myself. It's very powerful. Do you do any self-talk? Do you see any place? And this probably goes outside the bounds of the kind of work you do, Michael. So I'm just
not at all.
No, is that right? Yeah. Tell me about self-talk. What do you think of self-talk? Because a lot of people have negative tapes running in their head, and I mean, isn't that one of the that's a chief reason for why people suffer from depression? And a lot of times, those tapes are subliminal. They're running in the background. And it's like, I'm not thinking any negative thoughts about myself. Well, yes, you are. You just don't know that, which is why what electroconvulsive therapy is actually effective. I don't want to get into all of that, but you know, since I've got a person of your knowledge and background and education, Michael, I want to throw that out there, Michael. So tell me about self-talk, Michael.
So let's get a little dorky again. I'm going to translate this into a really cool research program called Query Theory. And I'll link it back to money. So the idea here is that with respect to self-talk, one of the most important ways that we self-talk is the questions we ask ourselves in our mind, Mike, and the framing in which we ask ourselves those questions. So think about if you're more likely to ask yourself, you know, if there's a half full glass, you know, oh, is that half glass half full or is it half empty? And those, to your point, those types of questions you ask yourself give you a particular point of view. They drive the direction that your mind goes in terms of the answers. So I just encourage everyone, and Mike, if they want to get dorky, they should look up query theory. The questions we ask ourselves in our minds actually drive our decision-making because it sends our brains down a certain path.
Give me an example of like what kinds of questions do you think most people ask themselves that they need to answer or maybe don't answer?
So
is there something that's common to people that they ask themselves, do you think?
I do. And so one of the questions I get most often in this business, Mike, is how much is too much to give to my family? And there's so much embedded in that question, Mike. You know, do I
have enough?
And
does that leave money behind, you mean? Is that what they mean by that?
No. It just means now. Did I do too much in the past? Am I giving too much in the future? And again, it has so many different dimensions to it. It has a self dimension. You know, am I overgiving based on my actual financial resources to remain solvent, Mike, right? To provide for myself, my spouse, my partner, whomever else it is that is impacted by those decisions. You know, have I disempowered that person by giving them too much because they haven't needed to make their own way, right? I've given so much to them that they don't need to do things for themselves. Have I given, you know, another reframe here is, have I given too little to them? Are they really entitled to more? You know, can I give more to them? You know, should I? Do others give more than I do? So there's so much in that question, Mike. So that would be a very common question. It's actually one of the top questions we hear from families in general. How much is too much to give to my family? How much is too much to give to my children? And they're talking about, to your point, people of any age. You know, 1-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 10-year-olds, all the way up to 50 and 60-year-olds, because they're children too. So that would be a really clean example of a question I'm talking about that people ask themselves, and that when I'm able to, I draw it out of them and really unpack what it means. And that drives a lot of their decision-making for themselves and for their families, and has a really, really critical impact on their financial success and the financial success and frankly, the life success of those surrounding them. Does that help give you context?
Yeah, it does. And although, you know, then there's the fundamental human question of, you know, I think people in one way or another kind of ask themselves, am I worthy? That's a big part of what some people, I mean, a lot of people suffer from a lack of self-esteem, and they really talk themselves down, whether consciously or unconsciously. Let me just say that the book I mentioned called What to Say When You Talk to Yourself, I quickly looked it up here. The author of that book is Shad, S-H-A-D, and it's Helmstetter, H-E-L-M-S-T-E-T-T-E-R. Anyway, if you plug in the title of the book to Amazon, it'll come right up. And also the fella that Richard Thaler reminded me of earlier when you were talking about Richard Thaler is Daniel Kahneman. You know Daniel Kahneman. Yeah. Israeli psychologist and economist. Yep.
Yeah, he won the Nobel Prize back in 2002, I believe.
It does mention the Nobel Prize. Yeah, 2002. You're right. You got the year right. Brilliant. I mean, just a brilliant guy, as you know. So, and for our listeners, I want you to be aware of this. I will say that the self-talk book, he has scripts in there, basically scripts of how you can talk to yourself to embolden yourself. But I will say that those scripts never really spoke to me. But of course, I think what he really meant is write your own script, you know, write what speaks to you. But here's examples of these scripts so that instead of using idle time and let your mind just run amok or standing in line with a blank mind while you're waiting for the checkout at the grocery store or whatever, you can be doing some good psychological work on yourself. So it's something to think about. So Michael, we're running out of time. So let me ask you, you know, you've spent some time with me now. I assume you've cobbled a basic psychological profile of me together. How would you characterize my psychological makeup? What is maybe most grisly about it? Or what's most positive about it?
Oh, Mike, I'm a pretty non-judgmental guy. I'm about as flawed as it gets.
And I know it's not really a fair question.
I wouldn't even pretend to psychoanalyze you. Here's what I would say, Mike, is that you come across as very thoughtful and curious, and you're someone, I know we don't know each other well, but you come across as someone that I would really welcome getting to know better and to debate about these things with. And so I'm always looking for human beings with respect to these conversations who are just interested in knowing more, learning more. So that's what I've gotten from you in this conversation. One thing I want to circle back to on your self-talk thing is really quickly, it can be very simple, right? To really give yourself confidence and encourage yourself. I don't know if you know this, but even imagining yourself as your favorite superhero has huge knock-on effects to people's actual performance on, you know, tests and, you know, in other aspects of life. So that is one technique I do use. I do think of my favorite superhero, which is actually my daughter's favorite superhero. Her name is She-Ra, to think about those ideas and give me the confidence and the courage to really make the right decisions and engage in the world in the right way.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I want to, you know, some people could look at that as, you know, imagining yourself as a superhero is silly. But one of the things I do on the side is I teach public speaking. And one of the techniques that I teach people is when you're walking up on stage, because everybody's got stage fright, when you're walking up there, we all have people who we think in terms of, I wish I could speak publicly like Jack Valenti used to do when he was alive and so and so. Just imagine yourself as that person. And it's amazing the effect it has when you try to embody that person. And another technique that I think you'll find interesting is you know, there was a book written many years ago about the child within, and what you really want to do is replace that child within and have that adult really kind of take care of that child. But when we have stage fright and we're headed to the lectern. That's basically the child that's frightful. And when you actually think in terms of that, again, the self-talk, and it's the adult that is now talking to the child and saying, I'll take it from here. Just relax. I'll take it from here. It's all in my hands. It has a tremendous effect. It's amazing. These are very simple mental gymnastics, not even gymnastics. They're very simple mental exercises that people don't spend any time, a lot of people don't know about, but they spend no time thinking about, and they could derive great benefit from it.
Completely.
So anyway, I open that up to you if you wanted to add anything to that.
Not at all. I think you said it perfectly, Mike. I think we should all just have fun actually taking the opportunity to do those very simple things to make ourselves feel great and give us the courage again to make the right decisions. And to your point, really get out there and explore the world and share basically, to your point on public speaking, our thoughts and feelings with others that could help them as well. So I'm with you 100%.
Well, this has been a lot of fun, Michael, and really interesting. And I figured it would be just based on what you do. And you lived up to your advanced advertising from Julie Andrews with the company. She was saying, said great things about you. And you've lived up to your advanced advertising. For our listeners, again, Michael Liersch of Wells Fargo and Company. He does a lot of research on the advisor-client relationships and what makes for a good or great advisor, what makes for the best outcomes. And you've heard him elaborate. You know, Michael, next time you have some new landmark research, or you have a breakthrough, or you win that Nobel Prize, I'd love to have you on the program again. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you, Mike. And I would be happy to come back.